Thank you, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? Well, I want to thank the committee for inviting me up, and Don for being such a great host, Clyde for taking me through the Air Museum out at the 8th Air Force, and Gary for taking us up in his plane and getting an air tour of the Savannah area and allowing me to make the first landing I've made in 40 years. You should have been there. Anyway, my sobriety date is December 7th, 1964, and I belong to the formal group in Tampa, Florida. The only requirement for membership in that group is a desire to stop drinking and you own a tuxedo. So, anyway, it's really I'm really happy to be here tonight. I've heard about this event. I think Keith was up here. Did Keith speak here not too long ago? Yeah, and he was telling me how much fun he had. When I got 40 years, not too long ago, you know, that's when you're an old-timer in the program. And so it caused me to reflect on things over the years and think about the old-timers that were here before me and how important they were. That it just seemed like I never would have made it if they weren't standing up in front of me. There was a guy named Buck Doyle up in Northern Virginia, and he just made, it was the Saturday night meeting at his group, and he just, his whole point was to put Saturday night back in our lives. You know, like you look forward to Saturday night to drink. I was looking forward to going to his meeting. And he always had a greeting at the end. They'd have two speakers and have all those things. And then he'd take about 60 seconds at the end of the meeting to just welcome the newcomer. And he had that enthusiasm. And I just knew that sobriety could be fun. Just from his energy, it made me realize this is not going to be a dull thing. And then I got inspiration from the guy who brought AA to Northern Virginia. It was an old guy named Bill Ames, and he knew Bill Wilson. And there's a great commercial area called Roslyn now up in Virginia, right across Key Bridge from Washington, D.C. And when I first got sober, that very valuable property was the Bill Ames Lumber Yard. And he owned the lumber yard there. But he loved AA. And when he sold the property, one of the first buyers was a church. And he insisted in the sale of the church that they hold an AA meeting there. It was actually in the contract to the church that they had to have an AA meeting in that church. Now, the church was on the side of a hill. And so these clever real estate people wanted to use the side of the hill as well as the church on the top, and they carved out underneath part of the church an Exxon gas station. And from that day forward, that church was known as St. Exxon's. And that's all we talk about. Hey, you're going to be over St. Exxon's at the meeting tonight? Yeah, I'll see you over at St. Exxon's. St. Exxon, I'm sure the members of the church had no idea what we were talking about, but that's where the AA meeting was. And I reflected on some of those things. And then there was more obscure things that have happened. I've been sober about 25 years. I always like to tell this story because you never know the impact of what you're doing. Maybe you'll never find out, but a lot of times you may find out later. And I was living on Capitol Hill. I had a townhouse up in Washington, D.C. I had a good job. It was Sunday afternoon. I was getting ready to watch the Redskins. And that's a big deal when you live in Washington, you know. And I had my popcorn and Cokes, and I was just getting ready. It must have been about quarter two or quarter one. The game's coming on at one. And out of the blue, at about quarter of one, I have a memory bubble of 27 years earlier when I was a flight student in Pensacola, Florida, going through flight school, and I had a very close drinking buddy named Bill Marseille. And God, we just partied and partied. I was married. He would be over our house and we'd be out doing all these things. And I always overspended. I don't know if any of you had that problem, but I would I would overspend, and then the rent would be due, and I wouldn't be able to pay it until payday, and Bill was more cautious, so I would borrow the rent money from him. Then I'd get paid, I'd pay him back the rent money, and this kind of happened on a very regular basis. Now, back then, I think rent for a two-bedroom place was $90 a month. Very extravagant rents in Pensacola. And it occurred to me, 27 years later, that I had borrowed the $90, and then he had got transferred to advanced training, and I was a couple weeks behind him, and I never paid him. And then when I got there, I pretended like I forgot. I don't know if you've ever done that. I mean, you knew that you owed it, but I pretended like I forgot. So I just would talk, Bill, how you doing? But in my mind, I knew. And then eventually, we kind of went our separate ways. And that was the end of that. And it went totally out of my memory system until I'd been sober, like I say, 25 years. And here it comes. Now, I don't know about you, but when I have things like that, there's two people. There's my conscience, and then there's me. And my conscience is going, you got to pay that money back. And I go, yeah, but not during a Redskin game. It can wait. And my conscience is going, no, it can't wait. You got to do something about this. I said, come on. I said, I only got 8 minutes. Well, I want you to do something. I said, how am I going to find this guy? It's a Sunday. I can't, you know, call the Marine Corps and see where he went and all that kind of stuff. And then my conscience would go, well, you know, he liked to ski. And I said, well, that doesn't help me that much. There's lots of ski places in the world. I only got 5 minutes now till the game starts. You got to try and find him. So I'm having this argument with myself, and I'm not enjoying it at all because I'm, you know, I got the stuff all ready, and all of a sudden my conscience said, they ski a lot in Vermont. And I went, okay, I'll cut you a deal. I'm going to call the operator in Vermont, and I'm going to ask her if there is a William P. Marseille III, there's not going to be two of those in one state, in Vermont. And if there isn't, then I'm not going to look for him until I can call Headquarters Marine Corps on Monday or something like that, because we only got 3 minutes till the game starts. So I dialed information. Hello, operator, do you have a William P. Marseille III? You do? God damn. Now I only got 2 minutes. Well, what's the number? So I get the number. Well, he won't be home. Da, 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 da. Ring, ring. Hello? And I go, Bill? Yes. Sandy Beach. Sandy, how are you? Bill, I'm in a hurry. I know we haven't talked in a long time, Bill, but let me just get to the point, Bill. And he's trying to tell me how he runs a gift shop at a ski resort up in Vermont and how happy and all this kind of stuff. And I said, Bill, you remember we drank a lot? And he goes, oh, yeah, I remember that. And I said, well, I never paid you this $90. And all of a sudden it came up. And Bill, I joined AA about 25 years ago. You remember what a bad drunk I was? And he said, oh, yeah. I said, it turned my whole life around. I can't tell you. It's the greatest thing in the world. And one of the things we have to do, we have to make amends. And as soon as this came up with the $90, I got to send you that money. I'm going to add a lot of interest on it. And give me the address, and I'll send you $200. He said, you don't have to do that. And I said, yes, I do. I have to do that. The game is starting, Bill. Give me your address. So he gave me his address, and I mailed the check out that week, and probably about 2 weeks later, I got a big box from the gift shop, and there was probably $300 worth of gifts in there, wind chimes and all these things. And he called back, I don't know, probably about 4 months later, and he said, we're moving down to North Carolina. I want to give you my phone number down there. We have to get together. And I said, yeah, we got to do that. And I never did. You know, I was almost going to call him, and I'm sure maybe he was almost going to call me. A whole bunch of years go by. I'm speaking at a convention in North Carolina. At the end of the talk, people are standing in line, And this woman comes up and says to me, "You don't know me, but my name is Kathy Marseille." And I went, "Oh, my God, are you Bill's wife?" She said, "No, I'm his widow." And I said, "Oh, my God." I said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And I looked down. She had an Al-Anon badge on. And she said, "Oh, didn't he tell you? He said, when you called him, you were so excited about being an AA that he joined. And he had 5 years sobriety when he died." So what was happening on that Sunday afternoon, I was being called upon to go on a 12-step call that I didn't know about. And that was what was happening. But it didn't look like that was what was happening. You had this impatient guy who's very anxious to get down and eating the popcorn and the Cokes for the football game. But I still managed to make that call, and I think back on that. And a number of years later, after I moved down to Tampa, and I went over to the Air Museum in Pensacola, and I was looking around. They have lots of displays of different airplanes, and they had the FJ-4. Bill and I both flew those. And there was this squadron that was a sister squadron of the one I was in the 50s. And they had all the pilots' names on a plaque with raised metal letters. And I looked over there, and there was William P. Marseille III. And it just brought back all these feelings about how much we influence one another. And you have no idea how your kindness on a given day or something you say can transform somebody else's life. And it was just such a nice memory, because of all the things that I did in my life, I've had lots of, you know, I had a good career in Washington and all that, but my big love was being a Marine pilot. And my alcoholism took away that career. I lost the whole thing after about 14 years. But I got thinking, but that's all right. It was worth it just to have been part of that gang. It was such a lot of camaraderie, and in spite of all the drinking and that kind of stuff, I have these incredibly wonderful memories. And of all things, I hadn't thought about these two incidents in the longest time. When I signed up for flight school, you had to take these tests. I was an infantry officer in Quantico, Virginia. And I liked it, but I saw these pilot movies, and I really wanted, I said, that looks exciting to me. So I knew I wanted to try that. And you had to pass a very hard test and a physical. Now, when I was a little boy, I had polio. And I had paralysis in my right arm and leg, and I couldn't move either one of them. But I was lucky that the Sister Kenny treatment worked. It didn't work on too many kids, but it worked on me. And I got back most of the use of everything, but in the back of my right arm, some muscles atrophied, and it left kind of a hole there. So I have to give you that background, because as I'm taking my physical, this doctor is standing behind me. I have no idea who this doctor is. He's standing behind me, and I can feel his fingers going across my back, and he comes to the hole, and then he pokes, and he says to me, "What's that?" And I said, "I don't know." Because I knew if I told them that I'd probably be out, because they're always looking for some reason to disqualify people. So I just said, "I don't know." And I felt his finger go in there, and I heard him say, And then he said, "Okay." And I moved on. Now, if he hadn't said okay, then I never would have had this wonderful opportunity. And so I've just had this feeling, after all these years, wherever that doctor is, thank you very much. I remember you all of a sudden. I don't know why, but I remember you. And then the other guy that I remember was a E3 in the Navy. And he was in charge of the swimming tests. We had the Dilbert Dunker where you go crashing in. You remember that, Gary? You go in the water and you have to get out underneath and all these things. And then you had a long-distance swim in the pool. I think it was a half a mile. And when I was a little boy, I almost drowned. I was under a long time, and they had to do all this pumping, and I came out back and revived, but I was very frightened of the water. I was never comfortable in there. So even though I could be in great shape and run a marathon or something like that, when I got in the water, just the anxiety would wear me out. So I'm trying to pass this half-mile swim, and I'm not making it because I'm just getting exhausted before I can finish. So I have to go back every night to try and retake this. And this E3, I'm the only one. And I'm coming over, and he said, "Now, Lieutenant, try the side stroke. I think that'll be a way that you can conserve energy." And I'd go, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." And, you know, and I'd go, and I'd do the best that I could, and I'd still come up several laps short. So I'd come back the next night, and the next night, and the next night. And now I'm down to the last night, because the class is moving on, and if you don't make it, it's over. So I go over there. I'm already exhausted from doing it every night for like 2 weeks. And I'm swimming, and I'm swimming, and I'm swimming, and I'm swimming, and I look at the clock, and I go, "No way." You know what I mean? I only got another minute. And all of a sudden he goes, "Nice going, Lieutenant. You made it." And he signed the thing and handed it to me. And I was probably 6 laps short of doing it. But he decided that I was going to go on. You know what I mean? I don't know why. I have no idea. And I just thought about that God, if these two people, I mean, these little things that happened along the way hadn't happened, I wouldn't have had the most amazing experience. So I just wanted to acknowledge those because it was inside of me to say that. What I want to do tonight is to talk to those of you that are new. It was an honor to hand that book out to you, and we all do wish you the best of luck in here. I like the sentence that says, "God's will for us is to be happy, joyous, and free." So there's no problem with trying to figure out what God's will is. Happy, joyous, and free. So if I'm not doing that, then I have obviously stepped out of God's will. I'm off on my own somewhere, because if I'm close enough to my higher power, that is the awareness that I have. And that awareness comes from being close to the higher power. There's a sentence in that book that you just got in the chapter of the Agnostic. And it says, the main purpose of this book, this whole book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problems. Now, that's a very important sentence. Because sometimes we don't think about that sentence enough. It says, the main purpose of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself. And it doesn't say, which will enable you to solve your problems. It says, which will solve your problems. What solves your problems? Finding the power. The power is the solution. Now, that may sound like, well, what is that? Well, as you get close to this power, no problems can exist. That's what the solution means. It means they're removed. They just aren't problems anymore. And I remember the first time I heard that, I said, that sounds like mumbo jumbo to me. What are you talking about? You got a life full of problems and suddenly some power makes them all go away? That sounds preposterous. And then my sponsor said, well, what happened to you when you went to the bar? Did you walk in there with a lot of problems? Oh, yeah, I always had a lot of problems when I walked into the bar. What happened after about 3 drinks? I don't know, but I didn't have any problems anymore, I can tell you that. I just looked around and I said, man, I like this world. And he said, well, where'd the problems go? I said, I don't know where they went, but they came back when I got sober. But after 3 or 4 drinks, there weren't any problems. Oh, that's a pretty miraculous thing. I was completely in a new world. I was given, as Chuck Chamberlain says, a new pair of glasses. It wasn't that anything changed, it just looked different. You know what I mean? I walked in there and the world was awful. And I went, one, two, three. And I went, man, what a great world this is. Look around. This is awesome. And I just loved it. I can remember one time I was drinking in a bar in the Midwest. It was a dump. I mean, this place was awful. And I went in there and I sort of said, God, what am I doing in this rat hole? But after about three drinks, I started looking around at this place. And I said, this place is magnificent. This is... They really ought to do a painting of this place. It is Norman Rockwell should come out here and capture this place. And then I started feeling some tears coming down, and the bartender said, "What's the matter?" I said, "I'm sorry, but I'm overcome by the beauty of the people that are drinking in here. My heart is touched. These are possibly the greatest people in America." Now, about eight drinks later, and they were all jerks, and we were in a fight. But there was a transition there when it was like a spiritual awakening. I just felt the love of the planet, and it was flowing through me. So I think we're all familiar with the effects of a power that can transform the world into a very comfortable place to live. And that's exactly what that sentence says. The main purpose of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourselves, which will solve your problems. To me, that's the crucial part of understanding that. It just means that if it isn't solving them now, we're not close enough, and you can find it all throughout the big book, so we have to more spiritual growth. More spiritual growth. You're almost there. You're almost at the miracle point. And so never stop until that thing happens. Now, when I arrived here, I had no interest in spiritual awakenings, sobriety, AA, or you. I was not interested in that. I was trying to get people off my back. That was why I was here. I'm sure no one else has done that, but I was here to get people off my back. And the people I was trying to get off my back were the doctors in a nut ward. These were the guys that were trying to get me. And I had, through some gross mistake, I was a patient in the nut ward and had been there for 6 months. And they said it was something about a grand mal seizure and the DTs, where I freaked out and saw a lot of scary things, ran around screaming at people, and they put me in a straitjacket. And so I was in this place, and they said, "We're going to return you to duty, but you're going to be an outpatient for a month or so while we figure out and get your orders ready and all that to go back to the Marine Corps down in Quantico, Virginia. So we're going to allow you to go home during the day and come back. I mean, go home at night and come back during the day, and you can be home on weekends." And so this was in late 1964, and the Redskins, again, they were playing. It was the football season, and I had a rule in my house. I don't know if you have a rule in your house, but the rule is you cannot watch a Redskin game without a beer. I mean, you know, some of you come over to my house, have a beer, have a beer. And if you weren't having a beer, we had a problem. Come on, come on, because I had that rule, never trust a guy that won't drink with you. You know, there's something suspicious about them. So I remember going home that weekend, and I said to myself, uh-oh, the Marine Corps told me if I ever had another drink, my career would be over, but the Redskin game is on, and I have a rule that you have to have a beer. And I remember actually thinking, gee, I hate to sit here with the set off because of my rule. And besides, I think those doctors overstated it. They didn't mean if you have a beer. They meant if you ever get drunk again. That's what they meant. They said if you just have a drink. But what they meant to say is if you get drunk. I can understand that. But certainly one beer. Now, I had heard all this stuff from some people that the first drink gets you drunk if you're an alcoholic. So I had a beer during that Redskin game. It was probably in late November of 1964. And here is the most amazing thing. I drank that beer and nothing happened. I didn't crave another beer. I watched the game. I behaved myself. I went to bed that night. I slept like a baby. I got up the next morning to go back to the nut ward. I'm driving along in my car, and I'm evaluating what happened the day before. And I said, I must be a former alcoholic. Because I had that drink, and nothing happened to me. Nothing. I was peaceful. No obsession, no compulsion to take another drink. I slept like a baby. This is the best news I've ever. As a matter of fact, that's all I could think of on the way up, was being free from alcohol. I was so excited that I couldn't eat lunch. You know, I just was down there. I was dying to tell some of the other patients, but I figured they wouldn't understand and they might tell the doctors. So I kept this new freedom a secret to myself. And I got home that night. I couldn't sleep this night because I'm free from alcohol. And I thought about that beer and how nothing happened and how free I was. God, it's so wonderful being a former alcoholic. I obsessed about that beer the entire week. I don't think I ate or slept. Because I'm now free from alcohol. It was wonderful to be totally free from the clutches of alcohol as I obsessed about the beer. So on that Friday night, I'm coming back, and I tell people, I went to the liquor store with this new freedom, now that I'm no longer an alcoholic, but know how to handle my alcohol and can drink socially now since I had that beer. And I knew that the best drink for me was vodka anyway. And I went into that store, and if I had had a lie detector on my arm and you asked me, what are you doing? I said, I'm buying a year's supply, a quart, that I would have passed the test because I honestly believed I was buying a year's supply. I mean, you know, now that I know how to just have one. Unfortunately, the bottle ran out Saturday, and I had to get another one, and then I had to smuggle one back into the nut ward on Monday because now I'm drinking around the clock just like it was 6 months earlier when I had the seizure that got me in there. And I knew they were watching me. Remember when it's funny, as soon as that disease kicks in again, you get paranoid, and everybody's watching you. Oh, I guess they can tell from my eyes that there's a bottle of vodka in my car in the parking lot, so I won't look at anybody. So now we're looking down like this, you know. And I'm sure everybody's going, what's wrong with that guy? And I'm going, they really are looking at me. I know they're going to get me. And so the next weekend, I joined AA. And my plan, when I called, made this great phone call, and ended up with my sponsor, who was another Marine captain, and I still have the same sponsor. I've had the same sponsor for 40 years. And that's hard to do because you both have to stay alive. And it's been wonderful to have this guy, Bill, in my life all this time. And I wish he could travel. He has emphysema. He didn't stop smoking. I stopped when I had about 8 years, and he didn't. So he's limited in going to the local meetings in Virginia. But anyway, my thinking on that particular day, Sunday, December 7th, I called the intergroup, was I'm going to join AA, and then when they catch me in the nut ward, I'm going to tell them I joined AA, and this is what happened. And then they could blame AA for me drinking again, and I thought that that would save my career. So when I came to AA, it had nothing to do with staying sober or any of those things. Anyway, he came to my house after I called the intergroup, and I got a couple drinks to stay down, and I called the intergroup back. I said, we don't need him. I feel okay now. Well, he was already on his way. And he came to my house and knocked on the door, and he was a big infantry Marine. His specialty was explosive ordnance disposal. And he said it was the perfect job for an alcoholic because no one's looking over your shoulder while you're working. And I thought he had a good point. And he came into my living room, and it felt like he blocked the entire door frame, you know what I mean, like that, with a shaved head, and it's sort of a mean look on his face, and he just said, "My name is Bill, this is a 12-step call, I talk, you listen." And then I said, "Okay, well, let me explain," and he just said, "I don't want to talk to you," and he went in to talk to my kids and my wife. "What kind of a father is he?" And all six kids, "Terrible, rotten, we hate him, we hate him, we hate him." And my wife, "I wish he'd leave, he's the worst husband in the world, and he's drunk all the time, he's terrible." And then I said, "Now, Bill, that's just their side. Don't you want to hear my side?" And he said, "No, get in the car." And I thought get in the car was AA's first step. He said it every time I had something to say. "Shut up, get in the car." And then I got to the meeting. I love to talk about my first meeting. It was in the Odd Fellows Hall in Manassas, Virginia. And the Odd Fellows Hall was old. I mean old. It's in December. It's freezing. And they have a space heater hanging from the ceiling. You remember those things that hang down? And when they cut on, they just went, whoa! You could hardly hear anything, and it just blew hot air, and he made me sit in the front row. It's like, bah! And the toilet was a non-flushing type, and it stunk in there. You had to take a deep breath outside and then run in and get through and come back out. And the meeting was the group anniversary, and they had ham and turkey and chicken and blah, blah, blah. And I hadn't eaten in months. I just had a liquid diet, you know. Food was very hard to even look at. And people are running around, "Isn't sobriety wonderful? Isn't sobriety wonderful?" I'm going, "No, it's not wonderful." Because I'd only been sober 4 hours. And the meeting lasted 4.5 hours. With the celebration, they had square dancing afterwards. They had speakers and all this, and fiddle playing. It was real country. And I was trying to run away. You know what I mean? I would go outside and look, and it was by itself down some little dead-end road, and it was sort of freezing sleet. Or, you know, it was just, ugh, out there. And I stood out there, and here comes another lady that it was like those other people I was talking about. An Al-Anon lady came out, Betsy Lynch, and she put her hand on my shoulder, and I turned around to see who it was, and it was this kind Irish lady, and she said, "Everything's going to be fine." And it was almost like the energy of those words went right through me, and I just went, "Oh, good." And I went back in and sat down. It was almost like I just was given a signal that everything was going to be all right. And it came from that touch, from that Al-Anon lady. And so that started my sobriety, and I haven't had a drink since. And my sponsor took me to meeting every night, and we had all the great beginnings in AA, which is go to meetings, don't drink, go to meetings, don't drink, and we're running all over. And at that time, there were probably 7 speaker meetings for every discussion meeting. And there were 2 speakers at all these meetings, so everybody had to talk at least 10 times a year just to fill up all the speakers that were needed. And so the 3 of us, there were 3 military guys, and we would show up at all these different groups. And, "Oh, here comes AA's military advisory group." And the 3 of us would come in and tell our little stories. And it was a lot of fun, and things are going along, and I got sober for 2 years. And it came time to get promoted. We were both captains. If you don't get promoted to major, then you have to leave. So the first year, neither one of us got promoted. The second year, my sponsor got promoted, and I didn't. So that meant my 14 years of service are wasted, and me and my wife and 6 kids are out. Now, that caused me a resentment. I know you would have handled it very easily, but I thought going to a meeting every night for 2 years would entitle you to something other than getting crapped on. And so I figured the one person to blame was God. And I was having a hard time with this God thing anyway. Everybody's talking about God, God, loving God, loving God, loving God. And then I'm going, thank you, loving God. We're going to starve to death, and I really appreciate it, God. I certainly understand what a loving God is. And I went back to my old God. I said, see, I knew I was right. When I was about 8 or 9 years old, I had been brought up in the Catholic Church with the nuns and the Latin and the incense. Now, my sister was sitting next to me. She's got 28 years in AA now. She thought the Catholic Church was the friendliest place in the world and still thinks so. And I was terrified. So you can see it's all in the perception. So anyway, I was sitting, and this is my first spiritual awakening. I was probably 9 years old. I'm sitting in the front pew. My parents always like, no, sit right there. And I'm staring at the crucifix. Couldn't miss it. It's 20 feet high. It's just there. And all of a sudden, it was like the true meaning of this hit me all by myself. This is just a secret message between me and God. And it was almost like a voice said, little boy, do you see that crucifix? I said, yes, sir. Can't miss it. It's there. Boy, it's there. Well, that's what God did to his only son that he loved. Guess what he's going to do to you? And I fainted right on the boop. Because of this inner awareness that I had, and God, I just was. So here I am now, I'm 35, and I'm having the same feeling. I was right when I saw that crucifix. That guy is out to get me, and he's getting me. So I had this resentment for a couple months, and I was reading the Washington Post a couple months later, and there's a little story on page 10 about a paragraph, and it said, Marine Corps instruction team from Quantico killed in plane crash in Denver. And it was my outfit. We were a team that went around to other service organizations with a big dog and pony show about the future of the Marine Corps, headed by a general, and I was the operations officer on that team, and they were all dead. And I knew that if I had had my way and been promoted, that I would be on the plane. So I had a little different feeling. But I also knew that God knew I just read that newspaper story. And I've been just letting him have it something fierce. So I mumbled around and I think I said something like, well, if you just told me this was going to happen, I would not have been complaining so much about what happened to me. And I think I learned a big lesson that you just don't know what some things, when they happen in life, what they mean. There's a lot of paradoxes as we move from the material world into the spiritual world. And I'm sure for almost all of us, when somebody ordered us to Alcoholics Anonymous, we felt like the worst thing in the world was happening in our lives. Come back a few years later and we asked the same people, what's the best thing that ever happened in your life? Getting in AA, no doubt about it, best thing that ever happened. I thought you at one time categorized that as the worst thing that ever. I was wrong. I was wrong. The magic words in sobriety, I'm wrong. First time that came up, my sponsor is hammering a point home. You know how we like to be intellectually self-sufficient? We don't need help in making up our mind. And he finally convinced me that his point of view was probably right. And I said to him, Bill, I agree. I concede. You're right. He said, no, Sandy, you're wrong. I said, hey, same thing, Bill. Well, let me hear you say it. It was like a toothpick was stuck in my throat. I'm going, I could not get out the words, I'm wrong. For the alcoholic, self-centered in the extreme, to admit that he or she is wrong is very similar to tugboats turning the Queen Mary around in a small harbor. And finally, I'm wrong. I mean, it's like a major effort. And then we find out this is the ticket to freedom for the rest of our lives. And we just go, God, what else am I wrong about? Get rid of it. Get rid of it. Get rid of it. It's just like freedom to find all the things that I might be wrong about because they're burdening me down. And where did I get these ideas? You know, they talk about old ideas, avail us nothing. What are they talking about? They're talking about your view of the world, which most of us put together by the time we were 8. You know what I mean? We just assembled all these ideas about who you can trust, who you can't, who's good, who's bad. Here's my little rule. Here's my rule. I learned a lot of secret information about life off of bathroom walls. And I'd be in there sitting down, and I'd read that, and I'd go, whoa, yay. You think that's really true? And I'd go, it must be. It's up there. Well, that's pretty scary information. Yeah, I know. Why don't you check it out with the other guys? Oh, no, I don't want them to know that I don't know everything. I never checked anything out with anybody. I just had all of my information that I had collected, and that was my reference point. And, God, you know, Chuck Chamberlain's book says it all. We come in here, we get a new pair of glasses, and we start seeing everything different. And it's wonderful to be wrong. Why would we want to be right about all that stuff? I'm no good. You're no good. Don't trust anybody. The world's a bad place. Everybody's basically evil. Forget it. You're a loser. You can't win. Would you like to get rid of any of that? No, it's mine. I'm going to keep it. I thought this crap up, man, and I'm sticking to it, you know. You got to have convictions. Yeah, I know. You spend a lot of time in jail with convictions. It's just amazing how we hold on to this stuff, pride of authorship. Yeah, I know it's stupid, but I thought it up. You don't see me changing my mind. Yeah, I know. We can tell. You look awful. I don't know what that is, but I had it in spades. I just love to be right. Boy, if I got in an argument with you at the bar and you wanted to stop the argument, okay, that's enough. Well, I'm not through. And furthermore, and then you might go home and go to sleep. I'd wake up at 3 in the morning. I thought of one more point. I'd dial the phone. Sorry to wake you up, Joe, but I just thought of one more point. Lee, did I mess up your connection? Okay. I got to keep my hands quiet. And I'd wake you up at 3 o'clock to tell you one more point about something. So it was very important for me to be right. And I remember the first time somebody in AA said, okay, Sandy, which would you rather be, happy or right? And I really thought long and hard about that. Okay, happy or right? Oh, no, that's a close call. Restore us to sanity, right? Happy or right? So this process of getting sober is really not so much learning anything as unlearning. Getting rid of information that is wrong. I like to describe that process. This is the way I see it. It's like this sculptress who did these beautiful marble statues of dancing women with the veils and the robes and all that are just so beautiful was asked how she did that. And she said, oh, I just get a block of marble and I just chip away everything that isn't that statue. In her eyes, the statue's already there. There's just this other junk that you just get out of the way. And this is what we are. We already are a magnificent, spiritual, loving creature that's set you free. You understand what I'm saying? So any ideas you have about yourself that you're this or that and terrible, rotten, can't be trusted, can't live up to your values, blah, blah, blah. That's all wrong. None of that is true, and it has to be taken away, gotten rid of, and that's really the process of the steps. So, geez, I'm not talking much about my drink. I don't feel like talking about my drinking. I got in a nut ward. You got to trust me. I drank. I really did. So this is what I want to say to those of you that are new. There's a chapter in the big book called There Is a Solution. And in there it says, the central fact of our lives, this is of AA members who have worked the steps, the central fact of our lives is the absolute certainty. Now get those words, the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered our hearts and lives in a most amazing fashion and is now doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. The absolute certainty that this has happened. So the steps are designed to take us down this spiritual path to cause this transformation, so that when you look at the world, it's easy to stay sober in it. I describe sobriety as a condition in which there's nothing for alcohol to fix. If there's nothing for alcohol to fix, it's pretty easy to stay sober. Because you're not sitting there going, God, I'm so uncomfortable, if I could have a drink. But what if you were totally comfortable? It would be real easy to not have a drink. You wouldn't need one for anything. This is the state that they're talking about in this spiritual life. There's another sentence. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. It really is true that you will know with absolute certainty that your Creator has entered your heart and your life. Well, how do you ever get there? I mean, this, and I like to explain this to new people. This is not a religion. If it was a religion, then I would have a big book up here, and I would say, well, the Buddha existed 3,000 years ago, and we have statues all over China, and these people for thousands of years have found happiness. So doesn't that prove that you should enjoy the Buddha or Islam or Christianity or whatever it is? And then you would go, oh, I see. That's what that higher power is. Well, okay, I'll believe in that. AA doesn't do that. We're a spiritual program. If there's 400 people in this room, there's 400 different higher powers possibly. But what do we all have in common? Why did we go down this thing if nobody could sell us on a higher power here? It goes into our first step. You want to get spiritual, take AA's first step. It says you're powerless over alcohol, your life's unmanageable. Now, in order to understand that, you have to understand that that does not mean that the only problem is that when you drink, you lose control and you get drunk and your life is all messed up. That is hardly a problem. Because if that was your only problem, all you'd have to do is not drink and you'd be problem free. You see what I'm saying? You just don't drink and you'll be fine. You say that to an alcoholic and you get a strange reaction. Don't drink and I'll be fine. You don't understand, pal. Something very bad happens when I don't drink. What's that? I'm sober all the time. That's what happens to me when I don't drink. I'm sober in the morning. I'm sober at night. I'm sober all week. I can't stand being sober. That's why I drank. I go into the bar. Bartender, you got something for people that are sober? Give me that. And boy, now I feel better. So how am I going to stay sober? Well, now the real problem comes out. I'm powerless over alcohol when I'm sober. You see the difference? I'm powerless over taking the first drink. We were talking about this in the car yesterday. If you accept, maybe you go through treatment, and they convince you to your soul that you're an alcoholic, and if you take a drink, it's over. Do you think that's of any help in staying sober? No. That doesn't help at all. Because we're powerless over alcohol. There will come a time when we have no defense against the first drink. So we have some guy, He's bought it to his gut level that if he ever takes a drink, it's over. And he's explaining this to his bartender friend. Joe, haven't had a drink in 6 months. I learned I'm an alcoholic. That stuff is poison for me. If I were to have a beer, my wife would leave me within, like that. And my doctor, could I have a beer? And my doctor told me that I might die within 3 months. And the bartender's going, is this guy crazy? He already told me that if he takes a drink, it'll kill him, and he orders a drink. That's why we're powerless over alcohol. So you say, well, how am I ever going to not take the first drink? You can't. On your own, there's no way you can avoid going back to drinking. Well, what can help me? A higher power. So there we are. We go into the chapter of the agnostic. I always like to go through this little routine because it's the best chapter in the book for explaining how to get spiritual. And I'll just quote you out of the first paragraph. If you're new, listen to this carefully. If when you drink, you have little control over the amount you drink, everybody. If when you stop, you can't stay stopped, everybody, then you're probably an alcoholic. Okay, we've already defined you. You're an alcoholic. And here comes the sentence. This is the killer. If that be the case, you are suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience can conquer. We're going to have to repeat that. You are suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience can conquer. And I read that, and my sponsor said, read it again. I read it, and I read it, and I went, wow, I never heard of that, mother. What is that? And I looked him in the eye, and I said, Bill, I don't believe in spiritual experiences. Oh, you're screwed. Sorry. You're going down. And I'm going, but what are you talking about? He said, Sandy, you're going to have to change your mind. Oh, man. And then the next paragraph. Here it is. Here's your problem if you're new. You have two choices. Die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. And we call you up on the stage. There's two doors. I'm the quiz master. And I go, Jenny, you have to choose one of these doors. Die an alcoholic death, door number one. Live on a spiritual basis, door number two. And you do what all of us do. Oh, man. Whoa. Oh. Oh, two bad choices. Whoa. Is there a third door? Oh. This is our old ideas. Live on a spiritual basis. What's that? Number one, boring. Number two, never any fun. Did you ever see Mother Teresa go bowling? No. What if I go through the spiritual door and I have to give all of my stuff away to the poor? Oh, no. And it turns out there's nowhere else to go. So we hold our nose, we take out our handkerchief, and we get spiritual. And we go like this. Okay, I give up. You have just won. You're there. You hold that thing up and say, I give up. And now you only have one question to ask for the rest of your life. What should I do next? That's it. In the beginning, you ask your sponsor and your home group. Then you may have a close-knit friends and you solicit their feedback on what to do next. And then you get a higher power and you ask that higher power, what should I do next? And that's the end of the game. If AA... The AA program, but you see, we can't accept something that simple. Our spiritual side loves it, but our ego can't stand that. Oh, I see. For the rest of my life, I ask, what should I do next? You don't understand. I'm a little beyond that. That may be for beginners, but I'm going to move beyond what should I do next. I'd like to take over myself. If staying sober was riding the AA bicycle, are you ready now? I'm going to use this as an analogy. You want to stay sober, you got to learn to ride the AA bike. All you got to do is ride down this spiritual path and you'll have the best life you can imagine. Oh, great. What are the training wheels for? Just get on and ride down the spiritual path. Okay. When do the training wheels come off? They don't. Okay. A couple years go by. Man, I got 2 years sobriety and I still got training wheels on here. I really look bad, don't I, riding a bike with training wheels? You ought to be able to go beyond training wheels, don't you think? Maybe I ought to take them off. The training wheels are the defense against the first drink. And they have to stay there. But our egos don't want them there. We want to wrest control of our lives back from our higher power. What we want is not to turn our lives over, but rather to have him help us on our plan. You know what I'm saying? I have a vision for myself, God, and I would solicit your help in achieving my vision of happiness. And God calls back, "You're on your own, pal." We don't work that way. It's all or nothing. And so we come to the real dilemma in the program. And that is, how can we turn over the rest of our lives as much as we did our drinking problem? And this is really what we have to deal with for the rest of our sobriety, is trying to turn over more. And if you read the 12 and 12 in the sixth step, there's this great discussion of the riddle of our existence. And Bill talks a lot about why it's so hard to turn over the rest of the character defects, and he surmises that one of the reasons is they're not fatal like alcohol was. And so we really want enough help to get us by, but we don't want perfect help. So let me throw this out to you. In other words, let's pick a character defect, okay, and see if you can get entirely ready to have it removed, like gossip. Now, would you like gossip entirely removed? Now, here's my answer. Well, I would like to stop originating gossip. But if someone else originates it, and I am simply an instrument in passing it on, then technically that's not gossip. So I would like to get rid of most gossiping except juicy gossip. And so I definitely want to make an improvement in the gossip area. That's what I would like to do. Okay, well, how about lust? How about we take all of your lust and get rid of it? And that would set you free. Wouldn't you be free? Yeah, I like that, but all lust. Isn't that like when you're dead? I think all lust is what I'd like to do is I'd like to get rid of most lust. That's what I would like to do. I'd like to get rid of that. Okay, all right. How about honesty? Wouldn't you like to be honest all the time? Why don't we make you a totally honest person? You know, I'd like that. I like the idea of honesty. But there are certain business situations where it's just standard operating procedure to fudge a little bit. So rather than be totally honest, I would like to have the reputation of being honest. That's what I would like. And we can start through these character defects, and we end up settling for, as Bill writes, as much perfection as will get us by. And so the struggle for the rest of our lives is to try and overcome the resistance to moving closer to this higher power. Now, when we read the promises, and I'm going to wrap up with this, when we read the promises, it just astounds me when we finish reading those promises and the reader says, "Say, folks, do you think these are extravagant?" And we all yell back, "We think not." We really should yell back, "Of course they are." How could we yell, "We think not"? Did you ever listen to them? Okay. Right over there, Mary. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave you. You think that's extravagant? I think so. How about self-seeking will slip away? It's like 50 ways to leave your lover. What do you mean, slip away? What do you... You're just standing there totally consumed with yourself and all of a sudden... Well, I just care about other people now. What happened? My self-seeking, I don't know where the hell it is. It's gone. I see. And you think that's not extravagant? I guess it is. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. The ninth step. There they all are. That's a spiritual awakening. Right there. Those promises are the exact description of a spiritual awakening. And right away in the big book, we start into the now living in this new spiritual condition, 10, 11, and 12. We've been raised up to where this higher power is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. We want to keep it that way. And Bill writes right in the introduction to step 10, we have entered the world of the Spirit. Now you see those words and you go, hey, isn't that great? We're in the world of the Spirit. Okay, take out a pad and paper and write down, what is the world of the Spirit? Well, I don't know, but it's in the book there. I'm in the world. Where is the world of the Spirit? So I'm going to tell you what I think it is. Where do you think it is? In Savannah, in Tampa? Where is it? In this room? This is where I think it is. It's in the now. It's the only place we can ever find it. It's the only place that God exists. The second we go back in the past to regret something, you're on your own. The second you go off in the future to worry about something, you're on your own. You no longer have contact with your higher power. You're on your own. So we have to move into this moment, into this moment. All that exists is right now. We're at this meeting. We're enjoying an AA meeting. We're having a celebration. Now, now, now. We don't want to be celebrating this and worrying about our income taxes. We don't want to be celebrating this and have a resentment about our brother. We want to be celebrating this. And so I think it's appropriate to give you a wish in closing for what we're celebrating tonight. Only I'm going to give it a new name. I'm going to wish you a happy now year. And I hope that your entire year is spent in the now. Because if it is, you will be happy, joyous, and free, and incredibly useful to everyone that you meet. God bless and thank you all very much.